Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I have no comments today, and I really believe that's a good thing. Well, in our last podcast, James Brandon and I finished our discussion of Charles Krauthammer's thought-provoking political essay titled The Bush Derangement Syndrome. Now, you can still hear that on podcast, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Well, today, James is back with me in the studio, and we're going to discuss a new Krauthammer essay. So welcome back, James.
Thank you for having me.
Well, just as a reminder, James is a literature instructor at our Imperial Academy High School, and both of us are enjoying this last day of school break.
Yes.
So before James gets very busy again, I thought we'd tackle a new essay. And this essay is titled The Mirror Image Fallacy. Now, I think that all of you listeners that heard our discussion of the Inner Man Who Cares essay, you're going to see this is really pretty similar. And, of course, I covered that with my wife, who absolutely loved that essay. And, of course, she wants to come back, but I'm going to let her come back some other time. I need some other new guests I'd like to get in here. So now all of these three essays are found in that chapter called Follies. So you can pretty much assume what this A will expose, and I think you can probably figure it out. It's folly. All right. Now, this essay is found on page 93 of the book, Things That Matter. And remember, this essay was first published in Time on August 15th, 1983. And as I've said before, these essays are really timeless, and Mr. Krauthammer really had a good sense of the future. I'm going to read the first paragraph. This is page 93 for everybody out there. Mr. Krauthammer is quoting from the New Yorker magazine. As is evident from just a look on his face, observes the New Yorker in a recent reflection on the Lincoln Memorial, Lincoln would have liked to have lived out a long life surrounded by old friends and good food. Krauthammer, that's the end of the quote. Krauthammer says, good food? New Yorker readers have an interest in successful soufflés, but it's hard to recall the most melancholy and spiritual of presidents giving them much thought. New Yorker editors no doubt dream of living out their days grazing in gourmet pastures, but did Lincoln really long to retire to a table at Ludice? So that's a restaurant in New York, and they do feature French food. So what do you think about that, James? What do you think about that introductory paragraph?
Well, it's classic Krauthammer. He loves his tongue-in-cheek. He likes to kind of poke fun a little bit, in a way that still addresses really some serious issues. So he's going to get into something, I think, that is really serious and taken to an extreme can actually be quite dangerous. But he's easing us in with something a little bit humorous that then he's going to draw a much bigger point from. But it is just fascinating to me. I mean, I haven't been there to see the Lincoln Memorial in person, but I've seen pictures
really?
Of it. But,
yeah.
You know, how do you look at that statue and read the man's mind? You'd think if they knew anything about Lincoln and what an ascetic life he'd had growing up, I don't think that they would have read into his cold marble eyes quite the same way.
No, I have been there, and I'll tell you, it is such a massive thing. I mean, when you see it in a photograph, it doesn't do it justice. You stand there, and the memorial makes him look like such a great figure. And, of course, he was ascetic. He grew up, country boy. He didn't go to, formal education. But you're in such awe of him, I can never imagine Abraham Lincoln caring if he ate a souffle or not in his life.
I think he probably had more of a Benjamin Franklin-type approach to nutrition.
Yeah. Yeah, vegetables and water, So, but essentially, he moves on to the next paragraph, and he's got our attention, and now he's going to launch into what he's really driving at, and I can never say this word. It's hard, but I'll just try and read it. This is the second paragraph. It's so solipsism. I think I said it right that time. Solipsism is a belief that the whole world is me. And as a mathematician Martin Gardner points out, its authentic version is not to be found outside mental institutions. Martin Gardner, by the way, was a really, he was a great mathematician, and he was really able to teach it very well. He had that ability to really, really teach math. He goes on to say, what is to be found outside the asylum is its philosophic cousin, the belief that the whole world is like me. Here's the mirror image fallacy. It's the way people look at the world, and they believe, as I think what he's really trying to say there, what people believe is everybody's just like me.
Exactly.
I love souffles, so Abraham Lincoln has to love souffles.
Who doesn't? Well, he gets to the meat of it in the last couple lines of that same paragraph where he says, indeed, that it yields a congenial world. This belief yields a congenial world populated exclusively by creatures of one's own likeness, a world in which Lincoln pines for his dinner with Andre, or more consequentially, where KGB chiefs and Iranian ayatollahs are, well, folks just like us.
Yeah, and that's like the biggest fallacy ever.
Yeah. And like I mentioned right after that opening paragraph, it's when you take this to the end, it's dangerous. If you take it to its ultimate ends, it's actually a really dangerous worldview.
Yes. And I know, of course, this brings up so much. Like, if you think about the KGB, and of course, you know, some people are, you know, very concerned about President Trump when he talks about Putin. And he says, oh, I have a good relationship with Putin. And I think there are some, I'm not wanting to criticize him. He may have a good relationship with him, but you have to remember he's ex-KGB.
Right.
And we know that communism still wants to take over the United States, still wants to corrupt our morals, still wants to get our children, to become communists. So you can't forget about that. And then, of course, the Iranian ayatollahs, well, we just have to be honest. They're not anything like us.
No, and I think we've got plenty of fairly recent history to show us that, too.
Yes, but unfortunately, James, there are a lot of people in this world that do think the Iranian ayatollahs are just like us.
Yeah, I'd say there's a growing swath of America that is like that, and largely young people probably, I think, just due to kind of this, the way that this some of this socialist communist ideals have crept into education over the last 40, 50 years.
Yes.
A lot of people my age growing up sincerely believing this kind of thing and having a worldview like this. Yeah. And I think it's especially going to be dangerous when people like that get into positions of power.
Yeah. Well, I think in some ways I grew up at the right time. I grew up in a very blue collar conservative family, and I went to conservative schools. And I even went to a public college that was conservative. And, you know, I don't think I ever believed that everybody was just like me, you know, kind of thing. But if you look at what's, you know, been happening, you know, in America, you know, early January, we know that President Trump took a stand and, you know, got rid of, I don't know how to even say it, Qasem Soleimani.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the backlash.
Oh, yeah.
From the left. I mean, these people are looking in the mirror and they're saying, oh, those poor Iranians, they lost their
beloved hero.
Their beloved hero, one of their best statesmen. And of course, the New York Times came out, and the contributor that wrote it was obviously Iranian background, and she said he was a great poet. And it gets back to the even previously when, you know, one of the other terrorists was executed and he said, well, he was a great, you know, religious instructor. And, you know.
I mean, Hitler was a mediocre painter.
Yeah. Yeah, he was also Catholic.
Yeah. I mean, how relevant is that, you know? Yeah,
right.
Are you going to try and distract people from the important truths here?
Yeah. But this is what he's dealing with, I think, in this essay, and I just found it just really fascinating. He goes on for the next paragraph down and says that now he changes it. Now, if everyone has to really pay attention when Krauthammer's writing, because notice the title is the mirror image fallacy. But notice the very beginning of the paragraph, he says, the mirror image fantasy. And so he's telling us what he thinks. You know, the mirror image fallacy is really a lot more than fallacy. It's a fantasy. He said, it's not as crazy as it seems. Fundamentally, it's a radical denial of the otherness of others. And, you know, that's a classic line that we have to see, is that, hey, everybody isn't like me. I mean, I love sweet potatoes. My wife doesn't like them. She likes white potatoes, you know.
Right.
And so I have to beg for sweet potatoes. No, I'm just kidding. So, but notice he says, or to put it another way, a blinding belief in the common humanity, in the triumph of human commonality over human differences. And so I think, you know, he's talking about, you know, a philosophy, but I think he's also talking about politics.
He is.
In many ways.
As I was reading this, the first book that I went and got to open this up and read alongside with it was My Politics Among Nations by Morgenthau, which is kind of considered the primer on classical realism when it comes to geopolitics. And I spent some time working with the international relations class here at the college. And so I've been through the book a few times and got some notes. And it was, as soon as I read this and I got to that paragraph, I went and grabbed that book because I thought, man, this really ties in with some of the stuff that Morgenthau writes about. Morgenthau talks about, in the very introduction to his book, he talks about basically two opposing worldviews, two ways of looking at the world. And one is, you know, the classical realist approach, which is the one that he wants to explore in the book. And the other is this utopianist worldview, which really ties in with what Krauthammer is referring to as a common humanity. This idea that as a world, we are one people and we should all work together. And why can't we all just get along and work together for our common causes? Because we're all people. We're all humans. And the point that Krauthammer makes is, and he's got 6,000 years of history to back him up, of you know, civilization's history to back him up, is that when it comes down to the way that people interact with each other, it's based largely upon a love of one's own.
Right.
And love of one's own, if the listeners aren't necessarily familiar with that term, is essentially just whatever your sphere is, your little bubble that you live in, you love that and you protect that and you fear anything outside of that. And that fear might lead to isolationism, or it might lead to aggressive behavior outward to protect yourself or to lash out at people that you feel is a threat in that to your own. And that love of one's own, it starts on as small as a level as a family, and then a family grown large is just a tribe, and then tribes become nations. And, you know, so you see that love of one's own played out in history on an individual level in families, on a tribal level, and then on tribes grown large, which are just nations, in how they interact with other nations. And so when you take this sort of, as Krauthammer calls it, a radical denial of the otherness of others, you're denying that the way that people interact is motivated by this love of one's own.
Right. Right. Of course, here at the college, and I think everybody knows that just the best literature is sponsored by, you know, Herbert W. Armstrong College. It's also backed up by the Philadelphia Church. I mean, even that whole idea of Morgenthau with, you know, is the way he looks at the world and tribalism, even the Bible shows that tribes are families just grown up.
Grown large,
I mean, here you have, you know, Jacob.
Right, and what is Israel? And it's named after him.
Right, the nation of Israel, and it's like he started out with his family, then the sons split, and then you have the brother Esau, which is is part of the Arabic nations right now. But he was he had his own family, and he was a tribe that grew up, and it is the way everything started small. It started small with families, then it built into tribes, then it built into nations, and that's what we're dealing with today. And even not every tribe of Israel is the same.
Right.
It never was the same. And
they don't all necessarily get along all the time.
No, you'd have the Jews fighting the Israelites, and you'd have the Benjamites fighting with all the other tribes.
You've got Reuben fighting, you know, allying and then breaking alliances with, you know.
And then they all 11 got together and got rid of Joseph, sold him into slavery in Egypt. You know, I mean, that's just the way the world is. But there are a lot of people today, and I think he's right in calling it a fantasy, that believe we're all just the same.
Yep.
And so why can't we all get along?
And the other thing Morgenthau brings up, and I think this will get into something we'll get into on the second page, is that if you're going to subscribe to that utopianist worldview, it's hard to sort of deal with the complexities of reality. And so you've got to kind of, he calls it the single cause theory, where you basically look at all the problems and you say, well, it all boils down to this one thing. And if we can fix this one single cause, we'll all be able to work together.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, in reality, things are generally far more complicated than that. Right. Problems are generally never that simple. And it's a give and take, and it's a compromise, and nations trying to work together. But that utopianist worldview is saying, well, we're all one family, so why can't we just get along? If we could just fix this one thing, then everything would be better.
Right. You know, over the years, there's been, you know, somewhat of a division, I think, in this country. Well, we know certainly during the 1860s, the Civil War, there was major division over how to deal with slavery and some other issues. Slavery wasn't the only issue. There was more. But, I mean, it really was a miracle to bring the 13 colonies together as one unit.
Yeah, I mean, it was divided even from the start before we even declared independence, the Tories and Whigs. And,
right.
You know, they all eventually, you know, I don't know, unless a bunch of people went back to Britain, you know, which I guess quite a few did. But this is divided from the start.
Right. And so the way I look at it is that this whole mirror image fallacy or mirror image fantasy is just the denial of selfish human nature.
Exactly.
We all are extremely selfish, and it starts, you know, maybe it starts with a man and then he marries a wife. They become selfish together, selfish of each other, then their family. You know, in many ways, I grew up in the 50s. It was a very peaceful time. But, I mean, come on, we had neighborhood wars. The families didn't all get along.
Yeah.
You know, we were Irish, Catholic, and right up the street were the Italians, and then we had, you know, we had other Protestants, and sometimes, I mean, as kids, we were brats, you know, sometimes the Catholics fought the Protestants, you know, and said we wanted our own things.
Playing out real history on a micro scale in your neighborhood?
Micro scale in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really, when I look back on it, it was terrible. You know, but the thing is, we were all different, but it was the philosophies we were taught. I mean,
exactly.
Catholics, you know, we were taught, hey, you know, you're it. You're in the Catholic Church. You're going to heaven. Protestants, they're going to, you know, they're going to the grave, or they're going to hell.
Yeah.
You know, because they've rebelled against the Pope.
Yeah.
You know, and so I remember the day when I actually got to talk one-on-one with one of my friend's mother who was ex-Catholic, who had converted to Lutheranism. And, you know, she even talked to me and says, you know, Dennis, the big problem with the Catholic Church, they don't read the Bible. And she got out a Bible and started showing me the Bible. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm really uncomfortable here right now. You know? I was just a little kid at the time.
Yeah.
But she was right.
Yeah.
Catholics don't read the Bible. You know, anyway, I just think that America has tried over the years. If we go to page 94, I think he talks about the Mayo jackets, the Chapras, the Chedors. You know, he said you look underneath the Mayo jacket, you look underneath the Chapra, and that's the Russian hat. You know, the fur hat,
the fur hat. Yeah,
and then the Chedor is the big. I don't know. You call it a black tablecloth.
It's like a more covering burqa.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but if you look underneath that, it's all the same. Everybody's the same. You know, everybody wants the same thing. The Chinese want the same thing as the Russians. The Russians want the same thing as the Muslims. It's not true.
It's kind of I think it's kind of the easy way out. It's kind of a cop out to say, well, we're all just the same. Let's all just sit down at the table and talk and work it out because we're all the same.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's kind of like, it's not that easy. That's kind of the cop-out.
Yeah, we can look at Congress today and see that we have, you know, some certainly Muslims in Congress now that they don't want all the rest
there's
of us.
A lot of people in Congress now that just don't have the same agendas. No. I mean, it's been that way for a long time, but it's getting increasingly more divided.
It's more divided, yeah. I think it's funny when he brings up, he's at the top of page 94, it says 11-year-old American anthropologist Samantha Smith was invited to Moscow by Yuri Andropov for firsthand confirmation of just that proposition, a rare Soviet concession to the principle of on-site inspection. After a well-photographed sojourn during which he took in a children's festival at Young Pioneer Camp, and this is in parentheses, but was spared the paramilitary training. She got the message. They're just almost just like us, she announced at her last Moscow press conference. And then this is really hilarious. Her mother, who is no longer 11 but makes up for it in open-mindedness, supplied the corollary, they're just like us. They prefer to work at their jobs than to work at war. And if you go back, and now that is kind of his history, but Samantha Reed Smith, she was born in 1972. She died in August of 1985 in a plane crash. But she was a Disney actress, Disney star. She got famous during the Cold War by trying to be this, this, I guess, ambassador for kids. And so
she was a prime target for some propaganda.
Oh, yeah. And they used it. I mean, the Russians used it.
I mean, the equivalent today might be saying, you know, okay, someone goes and visits North Korea. And you can go visit North Korea. You can go as a tourist there. They organize your itinerary, and everything is planned, and you're not allowed to photograph things. But there are some people you can go look online. There's some people that have done those tours that secretly had cameras. I mean, they probably risked their lives taking those pictures. They might not even have realized it, but you know, taking pictures along the way. And it's like, well, you could go visit North Korea and take this state-sponsored tour where the itinerary is mapped out for you, and you're not allowed to stray from the route. You're not allowed to take pictures. You're not allowed to interact with people except the people that your tour guides say you can interact with. And your conclusion from that, it could be, well, oh, look, it's not so bad. Life's not so bad. Everybody seems to be happy over here, and you know, this is great. I don't see why we can't just sit down at the table and get along with these people.
Yeah, but they're never allowed to wander into the
exactly. And it, but you'd think a thinking person would see that and think, oh, okay, what are they hiding?
Right.
In this case, paramilitary training, as Krauthammer's referencing with the Samantha Smith.
It's hilarious.
But
yeah, he goes on then to talk about. I think this is we just can't miss this. And again, this is all this blinding belief in the commonality of humanity. He talks then about Harvard cardiologist Bernard Laune, and he says he's talking about the syllogism or the deductive reasoning of all this. He says, we all have eyes, hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions. We are all fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer. It follows, does it not, that we all want the same things. According to Harvard cardiologist Bernard Laune, president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, that's not just Shakespeare. It's a scientific fact that the Russian and American hearts are indistinguishable, that both ache for peace and survival.
It's just
this is right after coming out of the Cold War, where, some 17 years after that, you know, the nuclear weapons were discovered, we were about ready to bomb each other off the planet.
Yeah.
So that's just wishful thinking.
And it was not even really that far removed from the Russian Revolution and everything that came after that. And, I mean, I know that we kind of learned more about that as time went on, but, I mean, you can look at the numbers of people that died. And how can you find commonality with a mind of someone who's willing to, you know, break a few eggs to make an omelet?
Yeah.
I forget who famously said that. Maybe it was Stalin, but I might be misquoting that. But I know that's a common trope with talking about the revolution. But
when you really think deeply about what Krauthammer is saying here, is in some ways he's pointing a finger, I think, at people who don't really know history.
It is. It's a simple-minded. It's kind of an ignorant viewpoint.
Yeah, it's like,
how are you going to deny?
Yeah,
everything that's gone before.
Yeah, and people are just so, I don't know, they're just so easy to forget history.
It reminds me of, I forget who did this. I want to say someone was criticizing something that a candidate said. This was back in the presidential race in 2015, 2016. someone had talked about their policy on Russia, and the Democrats kind of ridiculed him for his, like, his ancient approach to foreign policy. Like, ooh, we're in the modern era now. Like, that's not how we deal with Russia. You know, we press the reset button and forget everything that's happened. That's how we deal with Russia. But, you know, it's that kind of, it's that same kind of thinking of, like, really, are we going to ignore all the history? We're just going to say, nope, forget it. Clean slate. We're not going to remember anything that's ever happened.
Yeah. It is. I know I really feel like I need to read more history and study more history. I just bought a whole bunch of books on World War One, World War Two. I've got to go back and figure this out because we weren't taught enough.
Yeah.
We really weren't. I think the other thing that he goes on to say is that you know, people are in denial of this reality that, hey, you know, the Russians, what the Russians want, we want what we want, and it's not at all the same. And he talks about this whole idea of the down towards the last paragraph there, it says, as one news report of the recent conference of Soviet and American peace activists in Minneapolis put it, the issue of human rights sparked a heated discussion and provided participants with a first-hand view of the obstacles to communication which so often characterize U.S.-Soviet relations. And essentially what he's saying is there's, people can see there's issues, but we just can't find the right person.
Right. They're recognizing the same, they're seeing the same problem and coming to the two different conclusions about what the source of that problem is.
And you just have, we just can't find the right person. If we could just find the right person to get in there. And then, of course, he then talks about the broken telephone theory of international conflict that, hey, you know, the phone's just broken. We're all the same. Why can't we get the phone to work?
Which is what I, to me, when I read that, tied in with what Krauthammer wrote about the sort of single cause theory with anybody with a utopianist worldview, that, well, we could all just get along if we could solve this one thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this case, Krauthammer's talking about communication. If we could all just communicate better, if we could get the right person in to communicate, to mediate, we could all just get along. It's not that we can't get along, it's that we don't know how to communicate.
Yeah, like this. The thing that just kind of really surprised me the last couple of weeks was when and I can't remember if he was a senator or a congressman, when President Trump essentially executed Soleimani.
Right.
You know, he said, right decision, wrong president.
Right. Like, we would have backed it if it was someone else. But because it's you.
And President Trump's just going to cause this major war, you know, and then, and then there was that, their weak retaliation of, you know, so many missiles.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's really kind of stopped for right now. So
there are so many examples of that over his presidency so far, where, you know, he took what a lot of people would probably say was an old, outdated approach to foreign policy. That'll never work. You can't strong arm him, you can't scare him, you can't bully him. And he said, well, I'm going to try. And it worked.
It's, you know, standing up is what works. Yeah. I think it's funny that he goes on. I don't know if I have time to read the whole quote here, but he's talking about Saddam Hussein and Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini. And I remember this was all going on when I was in college. And, you know, there was all these Khomeini memes that before memes became really popular. And they'd make a big joke out of them. But he's just saying, okay, if you apply this broken telephone thing, you know, why there must be a broken telephone between Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollah. There is no broken phone. They don't want to call each other.
They don't want to talk. They don't want to get along. I mean, it's like the Middle East peace process with Israel and Palestine.
Oh.
You've got one side that is bending over backwards to pick up the phone, and the other side saying, no, that's not good enough. That's not good enough.
Again, we talked about that in our quarter book.
Yeah.
We went through all that.
Yep.
And, you know, Ibn Saud, or the head of the Saudis, I mean, it's not everybody in the Middle East wants everything in the Middle East the same.
No, that's, I think, a region where, you know, this fallacy is particularly proven.
It's just amazing. And again, these things are not going to get solved until, well, we solve the problem with human nature. Well, you know, that's all the time we have today for today's program. So next time we will continue our discussion of the mirror image fallacy with Mr. James Brandon. Now we're well into our series titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. We are reading selected portions of his book of essays titled Things That Matter, Now, there's more to come, and who knows, maybe by the end we'll read the whole book. But you can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to JBL at pcog.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.